I'm Laura Harper Lake.
And I'm Sarah Reitzman, and you're listening to Creative Guts.
Hello there. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Creative Guts, the podcast that gets to the guts of creatives.
In today's episode, we're talking with Steve Pamboukas, the president of the board of directors and a maker at Port City Makerspace.
I wasn't even aware of Port City Makerspace, and I am fascinated to hear what it's all about. So let's jump right into this episode with Steve Pamboukas.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So you are the president of the board of directors of the Port City Makerspace, correct?
That's correct.
So tell us a little bit about the Port City Makerspace and what you do there.
So the Makerspace is a nonprofit community workspace. Their mission is to offer tools, workspace, and instruction to the community. So Makerspace is not an original concept here in Portsmouth. Other Makerspaces exist, but generally they all follow the same sort of common thread of having shared resources, collective workspace, sort of a collaborative community environment that all revolves around making things. So just being creative, whether that's making art or making something functional or otherwise.
So who are some of the artists that are at Port City Makerspace?
Some that come to mind, I've been meaning to make it out to the Magenta Suite in Exeter. Mm-hmm. Shayna Gates is one of our newer directors on the board. Somebody else who's maybe their exhibit just ended, but Andrea Thompson just had a exhibit at 3S. I think it was called Unlikely Vessels.
Oh, neat.
You do get to see a lot of the behind the scenes happening at the Makerspace, and it's cool when you get to see the final work on display at a local gallery. She was making very large vessel-like objects. They looked like small boats or canoes that were made out of fiberglass and wood and then supported up on very large stilts. Depending on the exhibit, she either had the boats supported on large stilts or suspended from the ceiling with cables. And so that exhibit, I think, just ended over at 3S. But it was neat to see her producing that and then get to see it in a nice gallery like that.
Huh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's some people there who are doing things that are more, you know, artsy, fine arts, and some people who are doing more, I don't want to say like trades, but like woodworking and stuff like that that's a little more function-based.
I'd say probably the majority would be like the functional-based maker type. I don't get too far into the definitions of what's an artist, what's a maker, what's the difference, doesn't matter. But definitely, I think maybe the first reaction when we think about or talk about makers is the more trade skills or the more hard. Our focus disciplines at the Makerspace are woodworking, metalworking, electronics repair, automotive, and bicycle repair. So pretty hard skills like functional production. But we're also not exclusive to those by any means. That just means if you come to the space and you want to do metalworking, then we're well equipped to accommodate you with that. We have people who do screen printing and some stoneworking, some ceramics. So we don't exclude any type of creativity or any type of making that's going to happen there. But yes, I would say we're more dedicated to those sort of trade skills.
Yeah.
Something I think we all like to see more of is having like actual artists or real artists, however, again, you want to define that. So it is great when we do have these people sign up and use the space for more traditional or fine or, you know, contemporary art.
And how can people use the space? Are they renting it?
And do they get their own space, kind of like, you know, a studio space, or is it sort of all a free-flowing area?
Yeah, good question. And that's what I like coming here today is this is kind of my part of the grand tour of visiting other spaces that have some similarity to the Makerspace. I like going around and seeing the other creative workspaces. At its core, again, and I think this is going to be common from Makerspace to Makerspace, at least the ones that I visited, is, again, the shared resources, shared space. So at minimum, sort of the base model of the membership is it's exactly that. It's a membership-based structure. So it's a pretty large facility. We have each of those workspaces outfit, and when you sign up, our base level membership is the Port City Maker membership, $50 a month, and you are admitted to use our facilities. You have access to all of those tools during our normal operating hours, which we usually don't open until about noon most days. We close at 8. $80 a month, you're admitted to the Makers Guild, they call it. You can tell there's sort of some Dungeons and Dragons
I love it.
Nerds hanging out over there. Yeah. I like it too.
Do you play?
I don't, but I love all the lore. And
yeah.
I've been so close to the culture my whole life. I've played a couple times, yeah. not.
You're talking to a diehard player right now. I play Pathfinder two nights a week, so.
Cool.
Yeah.
And we've got model makers, and we do have the 3D printers, which are conducive. I don't know, I'm sure tons of variants of the different role-playing games,
yes.
But some may involve model making.
And little minis and.
Yeah, we do have those guys coming in.
That's neat.
So we've got the Makers Guild, which is, that's your true, if you're a diehard maker, that's 24-hour access. So I think that's a pretty cool offering that you can show up. You've got an RFID key tag. And you can access the space whenever you'd like. Nobody, of course, is touching any tools until they've been authorized to do so. So we have safety clearance processes. We have authorized permit authorizing individuals who will perform safety authorizations. And then at that point, people can come in and use the power tools. We've got table saws and welders. So there's a lot. You can't just walk in off the street and start using that stuff.
Right.
There's a lot of safety considerations behind that as well. So that's like the core of the service that we offer is the membership-based structure. And really what that's doing is giving people access to, for a pretty small fee, you have access to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of tools and equipment that most people would never be able to accumulate in a lifetime.
Right. And at its base, that's amazing having access to that. But then you also have access to other creatives. I'm guessing there's probably a lot of collaboration happening once folks, you know, are integrated in.
Definitely. Definitely direct collaboration. And I've called it one of the more intangible benefits of being part of the space. And then even as I play through that, I called it intangible benefit for so long. There are actually examples that I can think of that were measurable, that interactions that I've had with other makers there have resulted in me learning a new skill or gaining new knowledge. Like on the job, when you talk about some of the work I do with Portland Industrial Design, developing a new process or trying to come up with a fabrication technique that can allow me to do something kind of new or different, I can kind of be shooting the shit with somebody else at the space and they'll give me some advice and I'll learn a new technique from them where I can actually quantify it. I'll look back on the project and say, if I didn't have that interaction with that guy and I learned that, okay, so if I'm cutting glass and it leaves a sort of a coarse finish on the edge of the glass. Yes, you can polish it, but that takes a lot of time. I can maybe do less polishing if I, at a certain point in the process, coat the bottom of that glass, that cut edge, with mineral oil. I didn't know that.
Oh.
So that the mineral oil will soak in. It doesn't smell. It's not motor oil. Soaks into that kind of chalky surface of the cut glass. And yes, you could sit there, polish, 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 and get that stuff perfect. But when I'm trying to save time and not put in 100 hours into just polishing edges, and this glass is going to be suspended, you know, maybe 30 or 40 feet up on the ceiling, you don't see it so good. The mineral oil was the perfect solution. I said, wow, that saved me a lot of time, because plan A was I was going to do some quality time with some polishing compound. So that was I think that's at least one good example of it's not just the intangible benefit. That was actually measurable hours and dollars that saved me just from being in that space. And it was just an off comment. The member who I was talking to, he was a blacksmith, and he said, you know, bottle collectors, guys who go collect sea glass, it's a technique they use all the time. And I go, cool, geez, I would have never known that.
Yeah.
In terms of direct collaborations, yeah, I'd say so. Certainly with respect to, like, the place is kind of one giant DIY project. So there's always something that needs to be built or something that needs to be fixed, shelves put up or improving a certain workspace. It's a lot of volunteer run. So we certainly see a lot of collaborations inside of the space, people who use the space needing to make it better or improving it to make it more functional or more safe.
Have you noticed a certain type of consistent personality type? I guess I'm wondering, are there maybe some folks that are a little more introverted or timid that kind of come out of their shell because of these collaborations or because of the nature of the space? Or is it sort of all like, let's go out and work together, extroverts?
You see a pretty good cross-section of personalities. I think we do have a fairly, like, admittedly not the most diverse space in terms of who's going there. Mm-hmm. So I think by percentage, it's probably, I'm sure we have the numbers for it, but I'd say like 60 to 70% male And in terms of personalities, I think most folks who go to a community workspace like that are kind of open to the fact that they're going to be social. There's a certain amount of social aspect that goes to it. Mm-hmm. Everybody adopts that a certain amount, I think. I can't think of any great examples, but there have been times where I'm interfacing with a member and it becomes evident that they don't really necessarily want to talk all that much, and that's okay. I think that needs to be okay. I think that's an important thing about the space is that not everybody wants to talk all the time, and you sort of need to gauge that interaction right. on an individual level. One technique that we use, which is pretty obvious, is just the headphones.
Yeah.
So if somebody's wearing headphones, typically that means at least they're trying to protect their ears from a loud noise. It might also mean that even if they're not using a loud power tool, they just want to have those on because they don't want to talk.
Yep.
But I think people go in knowing that people are going to approach them. You are going to be approached. You are going to be talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem like most folks are pretty amenable to that.
How many members do you have at the Makerspace?
Right now, we maintain it. It ebbs and flows every month, but we're around 110 recurring members. So there's a lot. There's a lot of people who subscribe there. And so that's the monthly update that I get from our general manager. So that's how many active subscriptions we have. In terms of active users, it's fun. It always comes and goes. It's kind of a rotating community, but there's always a kind of a core group of usual suspects like myself who are there like pretty much every day. There's probably like 20 to 30 people. I call it 20 people who are there almost every day of the week. And then we've got a lot of members who you really just don't see often at all. They might just keep that membership to support the nonprofit and to come in when they've got that one very specific project that they've got to do.
And is there ever any congestion with, you know, 20 people in there at a time? I mean, from the photos online, it looks like a very large space with tons of different workspaces, but does it ever get trafficky?
It does, and it is a big space. We're really lucky to have the space that we do so close to downtown Portsmouth. We still haven't reached that point. Most of the time, no. Most of the time, it's not that congested. It is in ways sort of like the gym membership model that you see. Like, obviously, not everybody who's a member at the gym is there at the same time. The same is true for us by a lot. I'd say the times you see it getting busiest, we offer classes as well, so we've only talked about that one core aspect of our programming, which is our membership, but we also do offer a lot of classes. So that's going to be a time at which, so I teach intro to welding once a month in the metal shop, which is relatively small. It's one of the smaller, and it's an eight student class. It's pretty popular. Usually it sells out. So when I'm doing intro to welding, we don't really have any hard rules on this, but basically I take over the metal shop. Nobody else is really doing anything in the metal shop that day. So we kind of do, I'll come in to start prepping in the morning and say, hey, I've got class at 1:00. You're going to have to wrap this up mm-hmm. by then. And people understand because they know that the classes, that's a source of revenue for the nonprofit. So it's kind of a necessary evil. The wood shop, I would say, is the most heavily used. It's the largest workspace. I think that's just reflective of the craftspeople in the area, just a lot of woodworkers. And even then, on a Saturday, yeah, it might get busy enough that you've got 8 or 9 bodies in that room and it's just too much that unfortunately every now and then somebody might have to turn around and just say, I'm going to come back later today or mm-hmm. some other time. But thankfully, so far, it hasn't been an issue. And we've got a little bit more space. We can keep expanding as our membership base grows as well.
Do you need to be a member to sign up for a class?
No, definitely not.
What class do you want to do?
Well, welding.
Yeah, we have so many.
That sounds awesome.
We've got so many. We're always working on developing new classes. So we've got like the core classes that we've offered since day one, intro to welding, intro to wood shop, intro to 3D printer.
I want to do that. Okay, yep. I want to do all these.
Yeah, they're all good. We've got some new ones this month and next month. We've got our fall course catalog. I should have brought it, of course. But we have two classes based around jewelry making, which is neat. So a wire wrap jewelry class. And then a cold forging, so kind of using hammers to shape and form copper.
Oh, that sounds
I want to do
really
that one.
Cool.
I think they're neat. So those are the wire wrap jewelry. We've done a couple of those. The cold forging is brand new. And I think we've got other new classes on top of that. But we're always we want to make sure that we offer the core classes every month. I want to have intro to welding. I want to have intro to wood shop. Because this is also how we do that safety authorization is by taking intro to welding, you're now authorized to mm-hmm. use. So I want to give people as many opportunities as possible to gain that access to our tools. But in addition to the core classes, we constantly want to be expanding and offering new things.
do you see a flow of membership from the classes? Like people take a class and they're like, oh, I want to do this all the time now.
Yeah. And we could probably have better numbers on that as well. There's so much to do at a nonprofit. But yeah, that's kind of part of the goal is that the reason. So this is the second big branch of our programming is our classes. And yeah, the goal behind that is for one, that's our mission is to educate people and offer tools and workspace as well as this instruction. But also we know that there is a conversion rate off of that. It's probably the majority of my students are not members. I do have members who take the class, but it's usually folks who come in from elsewhere. And there is a conversion rate. We want that to be as high as possible. It's probably on the lower end, maybe 10 to 20% people will take a class. It's kind of funny because people will buy the tickets through Eventbrite or Facebook, wherever they see it. And you really do have to take 10 steps back and remind people, hi, I'm Steve. This is where you are today. You're at the Port City Makerspace. This is what that means. We're a community workspace. We offer tools, workspace, and instruction. And right off the bat, people are like, oh, I didn't know that. I just bought the tickets. It told me to go to 68 Morning Street. I don't know. And then you remind them and you say, so this we have a membership-based structure here where you can gain access to this space. That means that, yes, like a gym, you can come back and use these tools. This doesn't have to be your one experience here. And the gears start turning pretty quickly. And so I have to remember when I do my class routine to remind people of that. I know I had a welding class last Sunday, and I have at least one conversion out of that. So that was great. I saw him, one student, come back a few days after, and he was back in the shop and welding away. So that's always good to see.
Awesome. Really cool. Yeah. Are all of the instructors of the classes volunteers? Are they usually members of the board? Are they usually members of the makerspace?
All of the above. They are. They're volunteers, but there is a stipend as well. So of the class proceeds, 50% of the profit from the class goes to the instructor by way of a stipend. So we're not asking anybody to do anything for free. If you price the class right and if it's well attended, it's honest money, too. But for the most part, it at the very least will offset the time that you've put into plan and actually execute the class. A lot of our instructors are longtime members or newer members. The board of directors is largely, I think most of our directors are members as well. But we do have some, as we develop these new classes, we're kind of trying to reach out of our network. And we have some, the wire wrap jewelry class is Kathleen at the Seacoast Rep. She's not a member, but now she's coming in to teach our class, which is great. The cold forging class as well is a woman named Logan, and she has no other affiliation with the space. She's just going to come in and teach the class. So I think that's good. We're trying to, again, expand the network, what type of people are using the space.
Yeah, that sounds like a great thing to have people either on the board or teaching classes or in some way, shape, or form involved in the space that have no real connection to it. Really, like, grow that network and gain these ambassadors.
And that's one of the biggest things that impresses me with Shayna. I mentioned her earlier. She's one of our newest board members. I'm just, like, impressed because she's motivated. She works a lot. And I'm like, there's very little stake here for you. You don't have a studio here. You don't have I think she has a membership here, but she doesn't rely on it probably to produce her work. Whereas everybody else on the board, it's, to a degree, there's a certain amount of self-service. It's like, I want this place to survive, so I'm going to be on the board so I can help see it through. So I obviously have a huge stake in it. So it's the other board members who sort of really impress me. Wouldn't really matter to them too much either way, except that they support our mission,
right,
and they want to see it exist.
How long has it been around for?
I think they got started. Well, they got started as a business, an LLC in, must have been around 2010 or 11 or so.
And they switched to a nonprofit model?
And I think that was the plan on the onset. I think they had a little bit of they were pretty grassroots, but I think they had at least the foresight to know that an LLC is easy. I've opened – you send the Secretary of State a check for $100, you're in. It doesn't really matter. So that was an easy way for them to legitimize themselves and just start moving quickly. And I think they knew in the next 2 to 3 years after that they would start submitting that nonprofit.
That's a little harder than becoming an LLC.
It is. But, I mean, they got it on their first shot, and that's when I was a little bit less involved with the organization. I think they got it with as little muss and fuss as possible.
So as a nonprofit director and just a person who loves efficiency, I love this concept of lowering the barrier to entry by making those spaces and the resources and the equipment like accessible to people who may not have access to it otherwise. So I can see somebody who, say, wants to do woodworking full time, but is like, I can't open up my own studio, being able to take advantage of this and become a woodworker. And that's really cool. How do you make decisions? I'm assuming the board does this about purchasing equipment. Are you purchasing equipment for people who are already there, or rather skills that are already there? Are you purchasing equipment to maybe attract new people?
Good question. What the exact process looks like, it's probably a little bit different every time. There's kind of a fun structure in terms of how we manage it. I'll go a little bit into that. There's the board of directors. We have one employee. His name's Alex. He's our general manager. And so he's full-time. He runs the show. He's the guy at the front desk. So he has, in terms of actual employees, he's sort of, he's the administrator. He's got say behind just about everything. Beneath him, so we rely a lot on volunteers, obviously, to keep the doors open. We have those five focus disciplines that I mentioned earlier. We have volunteer shop managers. They put their hand up to manage one specific workspace. So I volunteer to manage the metal shop. So to a degree, and then I will work with the members to try and, especially the ones who use the metal shop, to try and get their opinions and some sort of consensus on what types of new tools we might want to buy. So the volunteer shop managers do help to inform what tools we need to outfit the facilities we already have. Lately, I'm thinking about, I need like a downdraft table is what they call it, which is like a table that provides downward suction for a dusty or a messy process. So if I'm grinding, it's going to suck all that dust right down to the table. It keeps the space cleaner. It's better for air quality. They're expensive and they're big. That's why I don't have one yet. But based on the way I see the shop get used, I'm like, we need this. Mm-hmm. So now I can fundraise. I can teach more classes, put that money aside, and sort of just go make that decision. Otherwise, there's a certain amount, there's a lot of conversations about, do we need to keep expanding our woodworking program? And we probably do. How do we budget in time and money to outfit new areas as well? And it's a little bit of a risk, because at least as far as we've been able to do, there's little way to quantify demand for certain things. So we've gone back and forth on that. If we build it, they will come strategy. And it's a huge risk. We do have processes that we've put into place. Earlier on, when the place was even more Wild West, people would show up and just kind of like take a corner of the shop and be like, this is the new leather working facility. And we'd be like, oh, is it? Okay, we don't know. Okay, go for that for a while. We'll see how it pans out. We put a process into place that's just like, if you see a chunk of space that you think could be better utilized or we should use for something else, here's the form. Here's the application. Fill it out. Let us know. Are you going to need infrastructure? Are we going to need construction permits? Do you need electrical? How much is this going to cost? Why are we doing this? What's the objective? Are you going to teach classes based on this? So many questions that need to be answered. And I think we're expecting, I look forward to seeing it. I think we're expecting an application for a soft goods workspace. So like a textiles facility, sewing. We already have some of this stuff. We have some sewing machines. We have a CNC embroidery machine. So I think it's got leg. I think it's going to be a good idea. I'm just waiting to see this application put through, and then we would approve it, probably put a little bit of money aside. And then this is investing in a new audience, a new network, getting new skills and a new type of person in the space.
I love that. That's so cool.
So it's still pretty grassroots. It's still pretty member led. And that's the biggest thing, is so much of what makes me hesitant to invest in one of these new spaces is not that I don't think textiles would be successful. It's more that, yes, it's going to cost money, but also we need somebody to spearhead it. We have limited capacity. We don't have a lot of extra resources. So if somebody really wants to commit and shoulder this and do it well, then yeah, let's do it. We can't just have somebody say, hey, this is a good idea. And then it just doesn't get built.
Right. That's really interesting. Do people bring their own equipment and leave it there? Or do they usually bring it home with them because they don't want other people using it? Is there any sort of system for that?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. Obviously, the main value of the space is that you can show up and that there's major amounts of equipment there for you. But sometimes there's something that we don't have. So people do frequently bring in their own equipment, even if it's just a simple set of hand tools like wrenches. Usually they're going to bring that back home with them. But it's not unprecedented that we've worked out like lease programs or, hey, if I leave this here and anybody can use it, can I get a discounted membership? We've done things like that. I'm usually pretty averse to it in the metal shop only because stuff gets beat on there, no doubt. Even when we try and do our best to teach people responsible and safe use of the tools, stuff just gets a lot of use. It really gets beat on. So somebody who donates something, or it like a semi-donate, like we'll leave it here with the expectation that I'll get it back in similar condition someday, they're usually not so pleasantly surprised 2 years later when they find a machine with a whole lot of hours on it. So I try and recommend, if we need this tool, we should fundraise and we should buy it. That way we don't have to rely on somebody else and maybe burn a bridge 2 years from now.
Right. Have you had folks donate?
all the time.
Yeah.
Big time. Yeah. People that I prefer.
Yeah.
And that's just what I try and make clear when we do these like lend lease programs. I'm like, so do you want to just give it to us then? Like, why don't just make this official? This is just ours now. And that usually that's how it pans out.
Yeah. That's great. And so in addition to being on the board and instructing there, you also do your own work there. What did you go to school for?
I studied mechanical engineering at UNH.
Okay. Okay. So you did sort of learn some of these skills. When did you start being a maker? When were you yourself a maker?
I think pretty young, I guess. I characterize myself as fairly curious, which I think most people are. And this goes as far back as the earliest I can remember is just taking apart toys when I was a kid, just for whatever reason, that desire to see what was inside of them. And I think way back to the most original, it's fun. It's like really early crude learning. You don't even know how to use a screwdriver, let alone that tool even exists. So it was a lot of smashing, a lot of taking. Like, we had I forget the name of the toy, but it was a teddy bear that also had a tape deck. Must have been.
Teddy Ruxpin?
There's only one. There can only be one teddy bear with a tape deck in his stomach. And you could play his little story time stories, I think, or something.
I feel so sad I've never heard of this. I want one.
Am I saying it right?
I don't remember
teddy
the name.
Teddy Ruxpin?
That sounds familiar. I don't remember the name of the toy. I remember that he existed.
Teddy Ruxpin. Holy cow, I got it right.
Yeah, you're
okay.
Right.
I didn't even have one, but I just remember it from that movie.
Can I see a picture?
It's really creepy. The creature's mouth and eyes move while reading stories played on an audio tape cassette built into its back. That's really creepy and weird.
Yeah, that was him.
That's so creepy.
And so, you know, we get our use out of it, and we play the tapes, and we did the stories, and then you grow a little bit older. Next thing you know, you could see the wheel spinning on the inside of the tape deck, and the ears are moving and whatnot. You just have to smash it to pieces in the driveway to see what's going on in there.
If you want to see what a Teddy Ruxpin looks like, besides Googling it, you should watch Walk Like a Man with Howie Mandel. So you smashed that apart?
Yeah, so that would have led to...
You killed Teddy Ruxpin.
And springs are going everywhere and pieces of plastic. And then as I got a little bit older and I wanted to do it again, the smashing things to pieces can be a little bit dangerous. You hurt your finger, stuff like that. You learn these more sophisticated methods of taking things apart. You don't use a butter knife as
a guillotine.
A screwdriver. Yeah. You can actually dissect these things and take them apart, and you might actually be able to put them back together. And so by the time I'm getting into public schools, I was interested in the technical classes, so like the wood shop and the electricity classes. And then that carried its whole way through. Portsmouth had a really good... tech program, you know, with welding classes, civil engineering. And then that ended up with the whole, you know, college prep track. I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to go to college now. If I'm going to pick something, I guess I'll study engineering. That seems to be related to this like inherent, you know, desire to see how and why things work.
What a great example of why our public schools should always offer those types of tech classes.
Yes.
This is something I'm always preaching about, and now I have, like, look, see?
And I think this was unique, too, in that maybe not unique, but as I look back, I see sort of a difference. Usually those trade classes, it wasn't always the college prep students. It was it could have been the kids who weren't getting as good of grades in the academic classes, and maybe it was kind of like that old-fashioned, like, okay, these guys are going to be the tradespeople, and these guys are going to go to college. I was interested in both of those things, and to me, I saw them as being very much related. That's what I thought engineering was going to be. I was like, oh, it's nuts and bolts and taking things apart, and that's kind of what I do anyway. It's kind of like that, but that's only one small portion of it. So I felt like I got a pretty good, you know, grounded education in both the hands-on technical aspects of the trade skills, but then also the, you know, I got an okay grades in science class, so I got to go to school too.
Right, that's great. It's time for a short break. Here's a word from our sponsors.
Bonjour, Vinny, my dear friend. You look très sad.
Well, Claude, I've lost my inspiration and artistic motivation. I need to find a place that could give me joy.
Say no more. In my humble opinion, Art of Front Street Studios and Gallery in Exeter, New Hampshire is the best place to find colorful and divine artwork. Have you heard of it?
No, but I'm all ears. What is this place of wonder you speak of?
It is a collection of 9 artists who have a gallery and studio in the building with a flower mural on it. And you know how I love flowers. You can walk amongst the artist studios, learn what inspires them, and if you're so inclined, purchase a whole variety of work, including paintings, prints, cards, sculptures, fabrications, jewelry, and even more.
are. I feel happy, joy, alive. Just hearing about Art of Front Street has rejuvenated me. Where can I learn more?
Visit www.artoffrontstreet.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram. They are truly a treasure to behold.
And we're back.
So you do welding.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your sort of primary thing, metalwork?
I would say so, yeah, in terms of what I'm the most skilled with and what I've done the most projects with. Yeah, absolutely. I do very little woodworking at the, you know, that being the most popular shop in the space. I'm in the wood shop very little. Yeah, I suppose that would have come. So there's the whole parallel conversation is my main professional job right now is owning and operating Port City Mopeds. So we do moped sales, service, repair. And so that's a fairly technical metal. Those things are made out of metal. So like metal fabrication, welding, metal repair is a good, you know, woodworking is not as relevant to mopeds and motorcycles. Metalworking definitely is. And so that sort of helped to inform the, the time that I've spent in the metal shop. You know, I took intro to welding at Portsmouth High School, largely didn't touch it again throughout college because engineering, I found out, is not hands-on. It's more behind a computer. And then I got a job at a prototyping shop after I got out of college where we were making one-off devices, little inventions, proof-of-concept type rigs. And again, it was a lot of metalworking. So it was a lot of learning on the job and bolstering the skills that I kind of somewhat had already.
I just rode a moped for the first time in my life 3 weeks ago.
It's a lot of fun.
In a circle in the parking lot out back here because my neighbor right here just got a moped from her neighbor for free and someone like helped her fix it up and fantastic. It was really cool.
Yeah. Exeter is really nice. Just I don't come out to Exeter all that often. Portsmouth is very congested and just so busy, and I'm convinced that the town is not well-traveled on four wheels anymore. At least if it's easy for me to say I'm pretty capable, I can ride a bike, I can ride a moped. It's not even enjoyable for me to be in my own hometown if I'm in a car anymore.
Yeah.
It's painful. So being able to put people on mopeds and bicycles and whatnot, I think it's better for them. It's a better way for them to get around, as well as I think it's better for the community. It's like I walk around downtown Portsmouth. I'm like, why do actually all of these cars need to be here?
Right.
They're actually kind of in the way. And they're actually not accomplishing anything right now either. They're not being productive. It's how when I'm sitting in my car and I'm just like shaking because I'm sitting in traffic, I'm like, I'm not producing anything. Neither is the guy in front of me. Neither is the guy behind me. All of us are just sitting. We're just wasting
producing,
time.
Carbon emissions into the air.
That's for
and
sure.
That's not good.
That's for sure.
And I also don't enjoy being in a car in your hometown.
No way. And so then when I get on a moped, and I kind of forget, like I'll be on a moped for 2 weeks in a row, and then I get in my truck again. I'm like, oh, this sucks. But then I get back on the moped, and I'm like, yes, I'm going. I'm getting there. I'm not wasting any time. I can park on the sidewalk. Same with the bicycle. And the bicycle is even better because you're actually being physically active for yourself.
Do you work with bikes at all in your shop as well? Is it pretty much mopeds and motorcycles or just mopeds?
It's mostly mopeds, some motorcycles, and I did just get I'm investigating electric bicycles right now. So this is sort of a new thing. It seems like there's a lot of buzz about them right now. It sort of adds a degree of resolution to the spectrum of transport. It used to be on foot, bicycle, moped, motorcycle, car. That was kind of the gradient.
Mm-hmm.
Now we get to add one more level of granularity to that, which is you've got the e-bike, which is sort of between a bicycle and a moped.
Right.
And so it's very much a bicycle. It's not a moped frame. It's a bicycle, Fuji. And it's just got an electric motor on it that kind of helps you out. So I don't really know. I don't know if they're going to be popular. I think they might be. I decided to pick up a handful of them this fall so I could kind of experiment with them. I've been loving them. I feel so active because I've actually been riding the electric bicycle every day. And I feel super fit. I am exercising. I got to remind myself that the electric motor is doing a lot of the work. But it's been a great fit for me, if nothing else. So I hope there are other folks who are like me who are at least somewhat physically capable. I'm not in great shape, but it's easy enough for me to get on a electric bike and pedal up and into the town. And I've been liking them so much, I'm like, I want everybody to have one of these. I'm like, I think everybody should have this. I think this is the best way to get around the town. I wish I could give them away, but obviously from a business perspective, I can't do that.
What's the price point for an electric bike?
That was one of the things that was a little surprising to me. It's about as much as a moped. So electric, my base model, like scooter, 49cc gas scooter is like $1,400. When I started getting involved with Fuji electric bicycles, it's pretty much their base model. It's around $1,400. So maybe bit cheaper, not really. So if you're picking between a gas scooter and an electric bicycle, who would possibly buy the electric bicycle? I've kind of come around to I don't think they're competitive products. I think you have two different groups of people. Mm-hmm. Somebody who comes in looking for an electric bicycle, they're pretty well convinced that they want an electric bicycle.
Yeah.
You might have a little bit of a swing buyer. Somebody might come in for an e-bike. They end up buying a scooter. But I think largely it's two separate markets. I'm going to find out.
So let's talk about some of the projects you've done. I'm on your website right now, stevebambukas.com. It looks like you've done a lot of stuff with clients like restaurants, for example. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that work and how that stuff sort of comes to be.
Sure. And thank you for sharing the URL. I laugh at myself because that website is a living draft. It shouldn't even be live. My partner, Nico, makes fun of me because he's like, why don't you just... What you're supposed to do is just keep it down until you're ready to publish the website.
And that's great.
And then you do it. I'm like, you know, nah, I'm just like, I'll just work on it live. I'm like, I only work on my websites when they're live.
It's, like it's somebody, part of the creative process.
Yeah.
And you're inviting us all to join.
So you'll find, I'm sure you'll find some pages with the lorem ipsum dolor or whatever it is at the end of it.
It's but, a look behind the curtain.
Yeah. So some of it's active and it is, yeah, it's a good representation of a lot of the projects that I've worked on. Yeah, so a lot of that kind of freelance side work resulted from the job I got as an engineer when I got out of school was contract-based. So I wasn't a full-time employee. It was kind of cool. I was used to this sort of freelance, self-employed lifestyle because I had already been running this moped business, which was seasonal, left time for other professional pursuits, picking up contract work. It seemed like I was like not moving towards a traditional type of employment, but always, you know, doing some sort of freelance operation or side operation. The design work that I do is the design and fabrication that I would do was, okay, you have all these skills. You've got the education as an engineer, sort of a designer. You have the ability and the tools by way of the makerspace largely. You can make these incredible things that most people can't. I'm like, well, I might as well try and profitize that if I can. I might as well try and make that part of my income. And so you'll see some projects that are reflective of that, of course.
I love the tractor seat stools at Earth Eagle. They're beautiful and they're reminiscent of a, you know, time when you're on a tractor. Maybe some folks haven't experienced that, but I have having chores growing up in Western Maine, and it just looks beautiful and it has a nice warm feeling to it as well.
Those were pretty cool. Those were fun to make. They I got hooked up with them. I live right next door to Earth Eagle, so I knew those guys. They were complaining because they had those just classic chemistry, like lab bench stools, which mm-hmm. were fine. They're like, we don't care what they look like. They're fine. They actually kind of match the vibe, but they break. We've replaced them 4 times since we've been open in like 3 years.
Oh.
I said, okay, well, why don't I just sort of replicate that design? If you like that design, I'll just make them wicked strong such that you can't ever break them. That will be a non-issue. Do you guys have any styling preferences on top of that? And then they came to me. So I do like the tractor seat stools as well. That wouldn't necessarily have been something that I would have brought mm-hmm. to the table, but I classified their style as like rustic meets kind of wonky. The first time I met with them, the one thing I came away from the conversation with was that the stools had to have tractor seats. That was it. They're like, we don't really care what they look like, what they do, but we do want the tractor seat stools.
Do they swivel?
They do.
The butt part swivels?
Yep. Yeah, they swivel. They do swivel.
Looks like you did all the seating at Earth Eagle.
We did.
There's the other bar stools.
Yeah, then we came back and we did a more, personally, I like the, I think I just call it the simple bar stool mm-hmm. is the name of that design. It's a very similar frame. It's actually a replica, all the same dimensions of that classic chemistry lab bench stool. It's just, again, it's actually well made. And
yeah.
The funny thing is when you look at the way those chemistry lab bench stools are made, I'm like, I would have to try to make something this week. I can totally see how this would fail. why don't I just make these, but I'll make them good. And so it's the same proportions. The accents are, the rung is a reinforcing bar for concrete. So it's got that kind of cool serrated texture to it. And then it's just a nice stained wooden bench.
Yeah.
And so those things are not going anywhere.
I'm also a big fan of the Growler Chandelier at Bad Lab Beer in Somersworth.
That was fun. Have you been there to see it?
I have been there and seen
cool.
it.
I haven't been there lately. As I built it, I'm like, this is going to be difficult to dust. I wonder how often they're going to dust this. But we also left them with like 20 spares.
Good.
So they've got a lot of spare. Yeah, and that was the story I was sharing earlier with the polishing of the glass.
Yeah.
That was
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting one where just through networking of one of the project managers when Bad Lab was opening. They really went all out. They hired Richard Lindvall. They flew this guy in from Sweden, I think, to do the design for their space. So I was like, that's pretty cool. And he had some kind of whack job ideas, these accent pieces like the growler chandelier. So he basically, he put together a pen and paper sketch, handed it to me, said, can you make that? There's always a little bit of cowboyism or salesmanism. And I absolutely. I can make that. And then you go and you do some research and I'm like, yeah, I can make that. So it's big rolled rings out of steel with, 64 ounce growler jugs, mm-hmm. the big ones, cut the bottoms off and turned that into kind of a neat lighting centerpiece.
I did just find some Lorem Ipsum.
Yeah,
I found some too.
I bet you did. It's all over the place.
I found it before you mentioned it, and I was like, oh, okay.
I totally won't know. Tell him. It is not a surprise. I totally know.
I wasn't going to tell him on air, quote unquote. But
no, it's just part of my web editing strategy.
Now it's like
strategy.
A little Easter egg. Our listeners can go and look and find it. Along with the beautiful work that's listed.
Yeah, big prize for the first listener who finds some Lorem Ipsum.
It's all over the place. It's not hard to find. It's a lot of content. I was copying a lot of content from another portfolio that I had. So it's a lot of, I got like 60% of the way through. I'm like, okay, this is easy. I'll do this some other time.
I see there is a section with some of that for art. Do you do any traditional, quote unquote, fine art?
I try to do. Yeah. I try to when I can. I respect and admire many artists because it seems like they spend a lot of time just producing art, of course. And I'm like, man, that's got to be hard. It's hard for me to make a living off of a moped business, let alone something that I'm actually billing hourly for all the time. Again, I can't see how these people find the time to invest all this money and time into their art and their craft. So I'm usually trying to find ways that I can make art while also being sure that I get paid for it, if that makes sense. And so that means a lot of proposals, a lot of concept work. So as to whether or not those have not always been super successful, but I have put together a lot of really cool concepts that I'm proud of that I do hope to have the chance to actually produce at some point. One of them would include the, City of Portsmouth had a percent for art project, for the parking garage. And so they put out a request for proposals. It was a really cool one because this was the first time that they ever did the Percent for Art project. And I think we did really well. Seems like you know a little bit about this. I pitched a few ideas. Again, I came in hard. I was like, oh, you guys want proposals? I gave them like three or something. One of them was actually good. It was a clock. It was called the Lumen Clock, which was an illuminated clock. Do you guys know the Foundry Garage? The structure exists now.
We do, yes.
There's the glass stairwell. I had an idea where we would sort of use big panels of light to sort of reimagine a clock. It would almost look like progress bars. Your hours and your minutes would be sort of illuminating one degree of resolution at a time. It looked nice, and I think there might be some concept work of it. And we did. We got fairly well through the end of the process. We were finalists in this. It got to the point where they were like, well, it involves electricity, which we don't love, and you're really, admittedly, we really did this glass staircase. I proposed taking it over. I'm like, no, it's nice that you think you're going to be able to look out those windows. I'm going to cover them with giant decorative lighting panels and they'll be illuminated and beautiful from the outside. But admittedly, yes, we will be taking up about one third of the glass area in that window. So I was pretty proud of the proposal. We produced some really good renderings. And I think I still think I might pitch a similar idea at some point down the line, but that one didn't come quite to fruition.
Yeah.
What do you know about the garage?
So Nancy Pearson has been on this podcast and she talked a lot about the Foundry Place garage because of course she's very proud of her baby, that project.
So you know about it. And so it made sense too. When I looked at some of the folks who also submitted the applications, you had Peter Hapney who applied and then he ended up having a very major role in producing the ironwork sculpture that is in the little traffic circle towards the end of the garage.
Yep.
And then another artist, I can't remember his name, but he did a kind of cool etched glass.
Yep.
And I think that was important as well, was that being the first Percent for Art project, they wanted some like guarantees. And it's funny when you start talking about art, they even said this during I pitched even wackier ideas that I'm not even mentioning right now. And they were pretty blunt in that they were like, we need a win. we need this to be successful. And I'm like, well, how exactly do you define that with art? What is a win? Wouldn't it all be a win? Being municipal, you got to be a little bit selective about what you're going to put on the side of the building.
Yeah.
And so I think in that respect as well, this idea was a little bit kind of contemporary and new, and the illuminated clock. It was a clock, but you wouldn't look at it and know that it was that. So it was a little bit weird. It's probably a lot safer bet to say, yes, an ironwork sculpture of hammers at the Foundry Place garage. This makes sense. This is cohesive. Let's go with that. Maybe we can get a little bit more risque in future projects. But Nancy was great. She definitely spearheaded that whole thing and did a good job with the execution.
Yeah, that she did.
We love Nancy.
We do. We love Nancy.
Also a huge fan.
So how much of your own stuff do you have in your own home? I can only imagine if I were a maker, my entire apartment would just be like my own furniture and my own things.
Oh, in terms of my furniture, I thought you were saying like how many tools do I have at my house? No.
I'm sure that's a lot too.
Good question. Honestly, I'm trying to think of any really good examples. Most of it is it's just regular old furniture that I've had for a very long time. I mean, my desk is a drafting table that I had through college. It was my brother's before it was mine, and so I kind of took that over. I try and be pretty intentional, I guess. I don't make everything. I want to know that what I'm going to make is going to lend itself really well to my skills. And
yeah.
I also know that if I needed a desk, I know that would be generally a heavy woodworking project, and I'm usually a little bit careful up front about investing myself into those projects when I know how much time it's going to take. This is the time of year where I have a lot of extra free time. The moped season's over, so I've got time for my more creative projects. I've still got original pieces that I thought I was going to be done with last year that I definitely need to keep the momentum on and finish this year. Otherwise, I'm just going to feel awfully silly and just like a person who doesn't complete things. I've been experimenting with the process of photogrammetry. It's 3D scanning, so to speak, except with just a camera. So by using a digital camera and basically photo mapping an object, taking pictures all around it, on top of it, below it, from all perspectives, you can actually generate a really good computer model based on that. So people mention 3D scanning. Sometimes it involves lasers or high-tech technology or a very specific booth. What's attractive about photogrammetry is that it can be done with just a camera. So I've been experimenting with digitizing subjects by way of the photogrammetry and then maybe 3D printing them and then using that to turn into a mold for a bronze cast. So it kind of comes all around and that you've got this real-life object that gets digitized and manipulated through these digital processes. And then its final rendering is in a kind of ancient traditional media, which is, you know, bronze. And I had some success with that last year, but I still have a lot of work to do. And that would be, when you think about me as being an artist or wanting to produce works, that would be the most direct project I have going on right now. They are works in progress. All I really produced last year was a bust of Abraham Lincoln, which was not, that was sort of me self-teaching. I was like, well, let me not do my actual pieces yet until I'm a little bit more advanced. I walked past a 3D print in the electronics lab of Abraham Lincoln. I said, hey, that's a really good model. I took it, I made a mold out of it, and now he's my mascot on my front desk at Port City Mopeds. You can come say hi to Abe. So hopefully this year I can get back into that, put my equipment back together, and hopefully finish some pieces. As to what I do with them after that, I have no idea. I'm going to do it.
Get your stuff out there. Do you have an Instagram handle or anything where you like show works in progress, or, do you want to connect people to like what you're doing midstream, or do you want them to see it at the end?
I mean, it's funny because most of, being self-employed, my businesses are kind of part of my identity anyway. Mm-hmm. So I don't really have a personal Instagram page at all. It's just the Port City Mopeds page, which is going to be very moped centric. There are some pictures of Abraham Lincoln up on there, but largely it's things relating to the moped business. You'll find one for Ports with Industrial, which is more related to the works in progress with that sort of creative design work. But I don't personally have any sort of Instagram page. Follow those, and then definitely the Port City Makerspace page.
Yep.
You'll see that's a cooler one because you're not going to.
Yeah.
It's not just my work. It's what everybody else is doing, which is usually some pretty incredible stuff.
I'm going to follow all three after this. I'm wicked excited.
And then I just need to keep them active.
Yeah. Yeah.
keep you some content coming.
Yeah. That's harder than it sounds.
we're at the tail end of our interview here, and one thing that we do on all episodes is rapid fire questions at the end, and they're exactly how they sound. They're going to be super fast, so we're going to ask you questions and, you know, keep it to a sentence or a word even.
Okay.
What other maker has influenced you the most?
Nico Gallo. No doubt. He's thoughtful. He's rational, scientific, all in ways that I think I am, but until I interface with him.
Aw. most inspiring location you've traveled to?
Rochester, New York. There's a museum of antique motorcycles. You see quite a lot of, it's kind of cool to see devices that are engineered, products that existed in industry before there were industry standards. So you see motorcycles, which today we very much, there's a brake and a lever and everything goes in the same place. But back in the day, they hadn't figured that out. So almost everything was a bit of a mistake on wheels. And they just rode it anyway until they figured out how to make it better.
Rode it into the ground literally sometimes.
Favorite piece you've designed?
I'm partial to the Lumen clock. I really like that design. I think it was neat. What I really liked about it was in terms of municipal art, I'm like clocks. I like clocks. Mm. It's a centerpiece. It's something that everybody kind of needs and relies on. And I thought it was a pretty unique way to represent the passage of time that I don't think has ever really been done.
Yeah. That intersection of art and function again. Love that.
Right.
When you're making, do you listen to music or do you like it silent?
It depends. If I do, I listen to the radio. I just like to have, I don't like to, I do use Spotify and whatnot too, but I don't like being in control over what's playing. It sort of almost seems like it's fake at that point. I'd rather have a DJ just there completely in charge. Granted, I picked the station, but it seems like a more organic, authentic experience if somebody else is controlling the music, not I'm sitting there every song. Plus, it's distracting. I got to have my hands free. WUNH, pretty much it. WSCA a little bit more recently. And, WXGR. WXGR is like the only... Do you guys listen to that? 103.5?
I don't listen to the radio anymore.
I strongly encourage it. The radio largely sucks. It's a lot of commercials. It's a lot of... I don't need to hear Led Zeppelin anymore. I don't need Aerosmith. It's okay. Bigger thing for me is lack of... I can't listen to commercials.
Yeah.
That's a killer. So WXGR, there are very few commercials. And what there are, it's all local places. It's right. Like the Hot Rod Cafe in Dover or...
WUNH is no commercials, right?
Yeah, they only have little PSA spots, which are funny half the time. And then with WUNH, you get the real experience. For one, they have a lot of very professional DJs. Everybody scapegoats them as like, oh, a bunch of college kids. Yes, and that's kind of fun for me because a lot of the college kids are good too. Not all of them. But there's just PSAs. You get the authentic. You're actually listening to somebody on the other end, whether or not they're actually good at it. So listen to those stations. I would strongly encourage it. And just tune on. You don't know what you get.
Yeah.
Eventually, you'll start to memorize the schedule.
I love WUNH because there's no, like most radio stations have sort of like a genre, like, you know, 107.1 is pop, you know, whatever. Yeah. And WUNH is like different every hour. So you could turn it on and hear like weird classical, or you could hear like jazz, or it could be like the reggae station or
definitely.
Yeah. And they're not allowed to play anything that's top 40 due to licensing reasons. So
that's
it's always
nice.
Going to be stuff that's not as popular.
And sometimes they do too. And they feel so guilty about it because it's like, sometimes super poppy songs are like kind of awesome to play. So like they'll play Lizzo and be like, not, they're like, well, we're not really supposed to do this, but we're going to do it because we don't care because it's awesome.
Who's going to get you in trouble?
Right.
What's your favorite color?
Black.
Favorite taste?
Coffee.
Mm. Yep.
Mm. What's your favorite smell?
Things that are volatile. Solvents, gasoline, lacquers.
I understand that because it connects you to what you associate that with. You're doing something when you smell that.
Also vanilla.
Yeah. Volatile stuff like vanilla.
Favorite texture?
Smooth.
Favorite sound?
Music?
Yeah. That's a good one. And this is the last one, which I think is our favorite to end on. If you could go back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
We're still on fast questions, huh?
Yeah.
Advice to give myself? I probably just want to stay out of it, I hope. I think both ends of me would be equally, I think we'd butt heads. I don't think either of us would want to listen very much. I think just leave me alone and let me do what I'm going to do, and it'll probably be fine.
Love that.
Yeah.
I think we'd both be know-it-alls. I think we'd both be like, oh yeah, you're going to try and tell me. Just when I was younger, I'm like, you're not wise just because you're old. to older. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. You're not better at this than I am just because you're old.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You have a better chance at being better because you have more years and you may have more hours in this one particular thing, but that's not a blanket statement. So right. Just because you're old doesn't mean you're right. And so that applies to myself as well.
Are you saying you haven't gotten wiser?
Maybe I have. Maybe.
You answer this like you have. Like, you have some DeLorean and you've gone back and your younger self was like, get the heck out.
I'm not doing that again.
Last time I did that, it did not go well.
I did not listen to me. What a punk.
I was like, shut up, future Steve.
And so, thank you so much for being here. We greatly appreciate you reaching out to us and wanting to be on the podcast. And we loved learning everything that you do. I feel like we didn't even hit it all. Like, you know, looking on all the stuff that you're involved with, you know, we definitely encourage folks to check it out, which we will have all the links on our Facebook page once this is out. And so with that,
show us your creative guts.
Thank you so much to Steve for joining us today on Creative Guts. I can't wait to check out the Port City Makerspace in person.
Yes, we're definitely going to go very soon and check that out. I really appreciate the kind of creative Steve is, which is he's always growing and expanding what he does, what he knows. So aside from teaching, he's always learning. Sometimes creatives, I think, get comfortable and stick to what they know. So it's lovely to see when someone is going beyond what they know constantly. Like, he just is always getting more in the library that's in his head.
See Steve's work on his website in progress, stevepamboukas.com, and on the Portsmouth Industrial Design, portsmouthindustrial.com. And of course, check out the Port City Makerspace online, portcitymakerspace.com, and you can find Port City Makerspace on Facebook and Port City Makers on Instagram.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. That was a lot to check out. Listen, guys, you probably want to just click and find it. So guess what? Go to Creative Guts Podcast on Facebook, and we will have links to all those cool things that you lazy butts can just go click on.
Our Instagram handle is Creative Guts Podcast. So if you're not already there, go find us.
Yeah. And our website is creativegutspodcast.com.
And better yet, just go check out Port City Makerspace in person at 68 Morning Street in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Thank you for tuning in to Creative Guts.
We'll have a new episode for you next Wednesday.
Do, 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 do. Oops, I'm at the closing.
Get with it, Sarah. Also, though, one thing about his episode, I don't know what we're going to use for a blooper. Nothing was that.
Nope, I know.
You know?
I know. I'm sure that between you and I, we can manage to produce a blooper during the intro or outro.
Achoo! Oops.
Bam, blooper. Well, a belated Gesundheit.
Yeah. Man, you can always count on Anne for a blooper.
She's the best blooper producer.
See Steve works.
Well, there's a blooper.
It was such a loud snort in my ear.
You know what? I gotta say, that snort hurt. My mouth / nose hurts from that snort.
Oh boy.
I friggin'
we are in
am
trouble.
In pain.
That crowd goes wild.
I gotta label these. Yeah, there's the sweet spot.
You picked the worst possible one to accidentally hit.